Allie, I've been waiting for you to show up and you're here now. So I'm very interested in hearing what you're learning about the Buddhist concept of generosity.
Yes, thank you, Peter, for holding the floor, and thank you all for your patience. I'm not sure if Peter mentioned I'm a psychotherapist, and meeting with patients ended up becoming just a situation where I ended at 8 o'clock. But I am very happy to be here and to talk about generosity. This is going to be the first of a series of talks that I intend to give on the paramis, with generosity being the first. And I am aware that one of our beloved teachers, Leslie, gave a talk on generosity around 2 months ago. So some of this may be repetitive, but there may be some new tidbits or framings that might provide benefit. And I was thinking, maybe two recent Dharma talks on generosity is emblematic of generosity itself, or maybe like over generosity, but that is maybe up for debate. So the paramis. Paramis translates from Sanskrit as perfection, transcendent, and having reached the other shore. The paramis are a series of virtues that, as the translation illustrates, ferry one from one shore of samsara to the shore of awakening. The paramis are six virtues. And in other traditions, there are 10 virtues, but these paramis are meant to be cultivated and practiced that not only carry one across the shore, but also serve as vehicles for living a meaningful and open-hearted life. So, just to overview what the paramis are, they are generosity, ethical conduct, patience, diligence, concentration, and wisdom. When we think of generosity, it's common for the mind to imagine examples like giving charity, making donations, or volunteering at a local cause or nonprofit, perhaps. And these are absolutely concrete expressions of generosity. And there are also subtle forms of generosity, such as giving presence, giving understanding, or maybe even giving forgiveness. At the heart of the matter, though, for any expression to be a true embodiment of generosity, whether it is these more concrete forms, such as giving charity, or these more subtle forms, such as giving presence, for it to be a true embodiment of generosity, the intent must rest in equanimity, compassion, and loving kindness. For the flower of generosity to bloom, it must have roots in the ground of benefiting all beings with certain nutrients in the soil. There is a nutrient of equanimity, and that the act of giving isn't motivated by desire or aversion. One gives not to reap some reward or seek reciprocity, nor does one give in order to avoid an imagined punishment. There is also a nutrient of compassion in that generosity is motivated by the intention to relieve suffering. And lastly, a nutrient of loving kindness, whereby generosity is motivated by the intention to care for the thriving and welfare of others. While any combination of these nutrients is essential for the flower of generosity to bloom, perhaps the most important condition is the soil or ground itself, which is the intention to benefit all beings. We carry out this intention to benefit all beings with the qualities of equanimity, compassion, and loving kindness. When considered within the context of the six paramis, it seems worthwhile to consider that the first transcendent virtue, the first step of getting onto the rowboat to cross the shore, is the commitment of benefiting others. So it's humbling in some way to consider that our own journey towards the shore of awakening begins with the virtue of generosity, of benefiting others. Rooted in this commitment, generosity can be expressed in a number of ways. Generally speaking, according to Buddhist doctrine, generosity can take the form of material aid, protection from fear, and teachings. Material aid is pretty straightforward, and it might be what we often first consider when we think of generosity. We cultivate generosity by giving away materials in our possession, which in Pali is termed amisa dana. We may donate money, clothes, food, or any object that may provide for the relief of suffering or benefit of well-being for others. When giving away material possessions, what matters most is less about the quality or quantity of the possession being given away, and more about the spirit or intention which carries that which is being given. I came across a story that actually captures this point very well, that really emphasizes the importance of the spirit in which things are given. And it's the story of the miraculous lamp. As the story goes, one day, an old beggar woman saw soldiers pushing many carts full of barrels of oil and garish lamps. When she asked the soldiers about them, she learned that the king wanted to offer the oil lamps to the Buddha and the Sangha because the light they would create symbolized wisdom and enlightenment. Where there is light, darkness would vanish. Likewise, wherever the Buddha and the Sangha is, hatred and sin will disappear. Upon hearing this, the old beggar woman thought, "It took thousands of years for the Buddha to manifest in this world. In this life, I have the great fortune to meet the Buddha. Why then shouldn't I make a light offering to the Buddha and the Sangha?" She immediately reached her hand into her bag, but only found two coins. She rushed to a shop to purchase a lamp and oil. Unfortunately, though, the two coins would only buy her two tablespoons of oil. However, when the old woman told the story about the Buddha to the shopkeeper, he was delighted and gave her another three tablespoons of oil and loaned her a lamp. Joyfully, the old beggar woman immediately went to the monastery in order to make a lamp offering to the Buddha before darkness fell. When she arrived at the monastery, she saw an assortment of exquisite oil lamps burning brightly and lighting up the entire monastery. She heard gentle, rhythmic music playing as courtiers, soldiers, and devotees paid their respects and praised the merits of the Buddha and the Sangha. As the crowds continued to mindfully and respectfully offer their lamps to the Buddha, the old woman stepped aside and, with mindful respect, polished her oil lamp. As she was pouring the oil into the lamp, she quietly prayed, "I humbly offer this light to the Buddha and the Sangha. My only wish is that I too will attain the full wisdom, just like the Buddha in the 10 directions." She acknowledged her modest offering as she thought, "With only this small amount of oil, this lamp will probably burn out by midnight." Despite this, she made her offering with sincere faith as she thought, "If I truly attain my heart's desire of full enlightenment, may this lamp forever burn and never go dark. After the old beggar woman made the vow, she hung the lamp on the tree and immediately entered the monastery, where she paid homage to the Buddha. All of the oil lamps that were offered by the king required that the soldiers take turns in order to fill the oil and change the wicks. This was necessary in order to make sure that the lamps wouldn't burn. Even with this effort, very few of the oil lamps were able to stay lit throughout the night. Some were blown out by the wind and others simply burned out. But the lamp that the old beggar woman had lit, even though it was hung outside on the tree, it was still burning brightly into the next morning. As the sun rose that next morning, the Buddha asked his disciple to blow out the oil lamps, and one by one, the disciple blew out the lamps. But when he came to the old woman's oil lamp, no matter what he did, he could not blow it out. Just as the disciple was trying, once again, to blow out the old beggar woman's lamp, the Buddha passed by and gently said, "My dear disciple, even you, with your psychic power, will never be able to extinguish this lamp because it burns with the merit of the future Buddha." It's a beautiful story that I think really captures how the spirit from which one gives can make a profound impact. And it also illustrates how it's not about how much or what is necessarily given, but more so the intent and the presence from which it's being offered. Khalil Gibran, one of my favorite poets, brings this point home on his poem, which is called On Giving. "There are those who give little of the much which they have, and they give it for recognition, and their hidden desire makes their gifts unwholesome. And there are those who have little and give it all. These are the believers in life and the bounty of life, and their coffer is never empty. There are those who give with joy, and that joy is their reward. And there are those who give with pain, and that pain is their baptism. And there are those who give and know not pain in giving, nor do they seek joy, nor give with mindfulness of virtue. They give as in yonder valley, the myrtle breathes its fragrance into space. Through the hands of such as these, God speaks, and from behind their eyes, he smiles upon the earth." When expressing generosity through material aid, at the core, anything can be given, so long as it is born from a spirit of equanimity, a spirit that is absent of clinging or aversion, as well as these intertwined qualities of compassion and loving kindness. In addition to material aid, generosity can also be expressed through protection from fear, which in Pali is known as Abhaya Dana. Abhaya Dana translates into the gift of fearlessness, which in itself is kind of inspiring and poetic. One of the primary manifestations of dukkha is fear. We have all been touched by fear in varying degrees throughout our lives. On a macro level, it may be accurate to even claim that our propensity to live in fear has grown with each passing generation as more and more people are diagnosed with anxiety disorders, phobias, panic disorders. It's an affliction that, on the extreme end of the spectrum, can be extremely debilitating and impair our ability to function. When we are caught in the throes of fear, it's often accompanied by feelings of powerlessness, helplessness, smallness, and vulnerability. Central to the generosity of fearlessness is understanding the suffering that is engendered by fear. And with this understanding, we are invited to offer resources to others that support the cultivation of fearlessness out of compassion the desire to relieve suffering in others. We can water these seeds of fearlessness in others by providing safety, protection, and refuge in various forms. We might offer a safe, non-judgmental space for others, providing compassion and reassurance to those who come to us trembling. By embodying these qualities of presence, empathy, care, and compassion, these qualities become our gifts, our offerings to others, guided by this generosity of inspiring fearlessness. It is essential to note, though, that the bedrock of providing the gift of fearlessness to others rests on the fearlessness we cultivate within ourselves. Fear can be contagious. If a person comes to us in fear and we ourselves are in a state of fear, or if we absorb the other person's fear, we will no longer be capable of serving as a refuge. A dear friend of mine recently shared a story which captures this beautifully. He was scheduled to have a minor dental surgery, which, although routine, was enough to plant the seed of fear. And understandably so, I'm sure most of us can attest to the experience of fear or dread arising in anticipation of a medical procedure. So, my friend, with the looming arrival of this surgery getting closer and closer, felt the seed of fear sprout into nervousness, and from nervousness into fear on the morning of the procedure. He sat in the patient chair, feeling the visceral impact of the now bloomed flower of fear in his mind and body. The surgeon explained the process of the procedure with presence and care, answering my friend's questions and providing compassionate reassurance to their disclosed fear. In spite of the crescendo of fear spiking around the start of the surgery, a beautiful transformation occurred in the midst of it. He described a moment of surrender where fear was relinquished and trust supplanted its absence. My friend recounted about the surgeon in that moment of surrender. It felt like she knew what she was doing. And so it was in large part this surgeon's embodied stability and confidence, coupled with her expressions of care, that transmitted the gift of fearlessness to my friend. If we were to imagine for a moment that the surgeon conveyed in overt or subtle ways being in a state of fear or insecurity, we would no doubt suspect that my friend's fear would have been amplified by a lot. In spite of whatever words of care or reassurance would come from the surgeon, the felt presence of her own fear or insecurity would surely override the impact of these reassurances, where they'd end up feeling more like empty platitudes. So this story, I think, is a great example that showcases the importance of cultivating fearlessness within ourselves so we may provide that gift of fearlessness to others. In a poem by William Butler Yeats, he writes, "We can make our minds so like still water that beings gather about us to see their own images, and so live for a moment with a clearer, perhaps even with a fiercer life because of our silence." The third and final way we can express generosity is through sharing the Dharma. It's considered to be the highest form of generosity, where the Buddha himself said, "The gift of Dharma excels all gifts." Which, when we think about that, it actually does make a lot of sense. It's analogous to the proverb of, "Give a man a fish and you feed him for a day, teach a man to fish and you feed him for a lifetime." Gifts of material aid or fearlessness are absolutely valid and valuable expressions of generosity. But gifting the Dharma elevates the preciousness of generosity from providing momentary support or refuge into the potential for liberation from dukkha entirely. One does not have to be a Dharma teacher to share the gifts of the Dharma with others. Giving the gift of the Dharma is an offering that helps another being move toward freedom from suffering. We might share these Dharma gifts by supporting others in their meditation practice or weaving the Dharma in our speech and advice to others. When others of their own volition express interest or curiosity in meditation, we might share resources or local sanghas as supportive invitations. In our speech and advice, we might offer the wisdom of impermanence, compassion, or equanimity as some examples. In my experience as a psychotherapist, I have found with pleasant surprise that many of my patients have shared feeling relief and benefit from simply reminding themselves when in the midst of struggle that this is temporary. And I say it's a pleasant surprise because there are a number of different techniques or strategies that I'll share with patients. And yet, a trend has emerged where the simple practice of acknowledging impermanence has made a pronounced impact across a number of independent cases. In those moments, these patients are not only exercising the wisdom of impermanence, but also self-compassion, since the act of reminding themselves of impermanence is couched in self-compassion as they reassure themselves that the storm will pass in those tender moments. We can similarly share generosity of the Dharma through embodied example. The more we cultivate mindfulness, loving kindness, insight, compassion, equanimity, and wisdom within ourselves, the more it transforms our very being. Our very being then becomes an environment that facilitates awakening in others. This approach is similar to the cultivation of fearlessness within ourselves, where the more fearless we become, the more we offer the gift of fearlessness to others through our stability of presence. Focusing on our own embodiment, whether that be a fearlessness or the other facets of the Dharma, speaks to the power woven in the saying, show, don't tell. They say actions speak louder than words, and that's true. But beingness speaks louder than both actions and words. When we focus on cultivating our beingness, nurturing mindfulness, compassion, and wisdom within ourselves, our presence alone becomes an offering of the Dharma to others. In effect, the highest form of generosity is not just the sharing of Dharma through words and actions, but more profoundly, it's sharing the Dharma through embodiment, which is scaffolded by our effort and commitment to cultivate the Dharma within ourselves. In the words of Ram Dass, I can do nothing for you but work on myself. You can do nothing for me but work on yourself. In summary, it's worthwhile to remember that generosity, the desire and intent to benefit all beings, is the first parami. Being the first parami, generosity can be considered the ground of all parami, where the subsequent parami of ethical conduct, patience, diligence, concentration, and wisdom are scaffolded by a grounded desire to benefit all beings. We can express generosity in big and small ways, whether through material aid, inspiring fearlessness, or sharing the Dharma. And while offering fishes to those who are hungry is unequivocally a noble expression of generosity, it is perhaps the commitment to develop ourselves as fishermen and fisherwomen that we can teach others how to fish, offering the most generous gift of all, their own liberation. The more we ourselves are liberated, the more our presence can serve as an environment for others to be liberated. And in the words of Khalil Gibran, it is when you give of yourself that you truly give. Thank you. That concludes the talk. And now is an opportunity to share reactions, ask questions. I know that, as I mentioned before, we recently had a talk and discussion on generosity. But I'm curious if there are any thoughts or feelings or questions that have emerged.
Will here in the room has a question, Ali.
Okay.
So, how do we deal with situations where you give so much of yourself and you get taken advantage of over and over to the point where sometimes you lose interest or you don't even want to give anymore and you're afraid of, like you lose trust in humanity? How do you continue on that path? How do you continue on the path when you have to learn the lesson of being taken advantage of when you give? How do you continue to be emotionally generous? All kinds of generosity that by presents and all those kind of things. When they get violated, how do you recover from that? Or any thoughts on that?
I think I heard the question. The question is essentially, how does one manage perhaps being overly generous and the effect that that can have on a person where one might feel burned out or overextended? Did I understand the question right?
Did you hear him say yes?
Oh, no, I didn't. Oh, okay. He said yes.
Yes, I did.
Okay, awesome. Thank you. Yeah, that's a really important question, and it is, I think, on par with how we talked about the importance of cultivating fearlessness within ourselves or cultivating the Dharma within ourselves and our presence. It's akin to this ability to be generous not only to others but to ourselves. We give these gifts of fearlessness or the Dharma to ourselves so that we can be generous then with others. And so it is important to be mindful of your reserves and how much you have been giving and whether there is some burnout occurring, because the point is not to exhaust oneself or overextend oneself where we are then at a point where we have nothing left to give even to ourselves, but rather how do we balance generosity towards ourselves and others so that there is balance? And I'm sure all of you have heard the saying, you can't pour from an empty cup. And I think that that's, I think the best way to answer that question.
Thank you.
Yeah, can I add to that, Allie?
Sure.
One of the ways that the conceptual aspects talked about in this regard is what's called the near enemy and the far enemy. And a far enemy of generosity is, being a Scrooge. is that kind of acquisitiveness and deeply implanted greed. The near enemy is something that seems to be generosity, but instead has an element of giving to get. And it's normal and natural for us to encounter this, that there's this notion that I'm being generous, I'm giving whatever. Patience or material things or even forgiveness that somehow or other I'm being generous in that regard, which you talked about. But behind it is an assumption that there should be some reciprocity, that it should be recognized, should be rewarded. I'm going to love you the way I think you should be loved, and you should appreciate that. And you should love me back the way I expect you to love me back. And one of the core elements of generosity is renunciation, letting go of a particular identity or possession or knowledge. So I think that's an important part of it as well, Will, in terms of dealing with that. Because when we are generous, particularly when we're generous on big ticket items, and it doesn't turn out the way we hoped, then it hurts. And it's frustrating, and we lose confidence. But that's because of the near enemy. So that's the place to investigate, is how attached we are to what we're giving.
Right.
And the expectations that are bound up in that.
I like what you said about generosity should always go with renunciation. I think that really makes sense.
Yeah. Allie, Steve, I think,
let's
share.
And there's also, of course, you know, desire that works in there as a near enemy as well. We all want to feel good and feel like we're doing good, but how do we know that we're really doing good? That requires being able to see the outcome of our actions. And without that, like, just, you know, and there's plenty of ways in this culture that it promotes you to give. It shows you images, they tell you stories, and you really have no clue at all where that goes. But it makes you feel good if you have good intentions, right? But I have a really bad experience with what you're talking about, good intentions and fearlessness. And I've spoken of it before to some of you, that, you know, this involved my mother, who was going through cancer treatment and was connected with a family member in Israel, very devout, Orthodox Jew, who somehow developed this ability to cure cancer. Even is online with podcasts teaching people how they can heal cancer, and had been rejected in what he wanted to do by our medical team and by the family, but kept pushing until finally he was able to get what he wanted, which was to have that control and to you know, interfere with the process of her treatment. And giving her that fearlessness, right? I mean, he had good intentions. He had, you know, he made her believe, and she was mentioning, oh, I'm going to get stronger and I'm going to beat this cancer. And what actually happened was this occurred without any of our knowledge, but he sent in plenty of things, took her off of the medication that she was on, and instead of getting stronger, within a week was hunched over and in, you know, just terrible pain. We had a telehealth session. This was during COVID with the oncologist, and, you know, according to him, I mean, and I see it in the blood work, okay, she was looking good, stable, but here she was in pain, hunched over, couldn't speak, And all he can say is, "Arlene, Arlene, I don't know what's wrong with you, but it's not the cancer." And she went into the hospital just shortly thereafter. I mean, complete reversal from being stable. And to this day, this person believes he had good intentions, that he tried to save a life, and that he was trying to make her feel good, and takes no responsibility whatsoever for those good intentions and that fearlessness. So there is this, you know, just the, it's not enough to have the intention, right? We have to know, be able to see and take and see what our the outcome is of our actions. I mean, how much harm has been done in this world by good intentions?
That is an incredibly valid and important point, Steve. And I really appreciate you sharing that. I could only imagine how stressful and disorienting that whole experience must have been. And I might respond to that by noting something that you said, which stood out to me, which was towards the tail end of it. You said, you know, he believed that he had good intentions. And believing that one has good intentions and having good intentions may be two different things. Because on the one hand, believing that one has good intentions could very well be rooted in ignorance and delusion. Whereas good intentions that stem from wisdom and wholesomeness and compassion, true compassion, may very well have a different effect in terms of the outcome. I know it's been said, probably, I'm sure in other talks, and Peter, I'm sure you can attest to this, but, you know, wholesome thoughts or actions lead to an effect of wholesome outcomes, whereas unwholesome thoughts or actions lead to unwholesome outcomes. And so you're right, Steve, in that it is important to be aware of what the potential outcome be from a certain action that is, say, rooted in a professed good intention. And I think what this really points to is really the importance of discernment within ourselves. Is this good intention that I'm claiming to be a good intention really true? Or is it rooted in ignorance in some way? Is it rooted in pride? Is it rooted in a desire to reap some reward or avoid some consequence? So discernment is really important.
Well said, Nellie.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Now, Allie, do you want to just make a few more comments about how generosity integrates with the other paramis? Just a quick, touch and go about how they support one another.
That is a, that's certainly an invitation, a question. I don't know if I can say with confidence or competence that I can, in this moment, relate generosity to the rest. And I mean, I'm sure if I were to go down the list, I can maybe make some valid inferences. But I might reserve that for the subsequent talks. So for the subsequent paramis, I might include a little tidbit that weaves in how generosity relates. But I guess,
Station, not a test.
yeah, I know. I did actually have, some discussion questions that I was curious to offer. And one of them was on actually the question that Will had presented, but another that I had was how people see this dynamic between giving and receiving. Because,
People are
I,
participating,
huh?
how the folks participating in this meeting perceive.
Yeah, right. Because I mean, there is that dynamic. There is a giver and there is a receiver, and there are feelings. I mean, we've been talking right about like what comes up for a person when they are giving. Are they giving because they want something, because they don't want something? So there are all of these emotions or states that can arise from the standpoint of the giver. What about the receiver? What might come up for some of you when you are the recipient of a gift?
A really good question.
Thank you.
Let me comment on that then.
Sure.
One of the spin-offs for me about this whole issue of generosity is gratitude. That as my practice matures, I have more and more gratitude about the benefits that I've gotten from the practice. And that includes being the recipient of the wisdom of people whose books I've read, or who have led retreats that I've participated in, or given Dharma talks that I've listened to. And that gratitude is part of what inspires me to be generous. It's sort of like a feedback loop. It just keeps reverberating back and forth. I feel more grateful, so I'm more generous, and also generous with patience, being patient. When I'm saying this, I'm thinking about my relationship with my dog. I'm very generous to our dog, Mary, Merrie. And I notice when her response, she shows gratitude. And that reinforces the bond between her and I. And it's a very simple thing. A relationship with a pet, particularly a dog, is not as complicated as a relationship with a human. So I enjoy being generous to her and am grateful for her enthusiastic interest in what's going to happen next, what's going to happen next, what's going to happen next in our relationship. That's what I get from her. She gives me this look in her eye. It's like, okay, what are you and I going to do next? What kind of fun are we going to have next? So that's kind of what goes on for me in that exchange about generosity. It's a lot of gratitude, which motivates more generosity.
A really good point, and it has me thinking about the yin and yang type quality of this giver receiver dynamic, where there is a seed of receiving and giving, and there is a seed of giving and receiving. When one gives, they are receiving an opportunity to practice generosity. And that opportunity to practice generosity often brings these fruits, as you said, Peter, of joy and gratitude. And then likewise, the recipient or the receiver is giving that space, is giving that opportunity. And so there is an interesting interdependency between that dynamic, and I imagine can be extrapolated to most, you know, dualistic dynamics. But I think it's worthwhile to be curious about how one feels in the role of giver and the role of recipient. Yeah, Andy.
Yeah, Ali. I don't know if you can hear me.
Sharon. Andy had just raised his hand. It was actually at the same time, huh?
Go ahead, Sharon. That's good. I can wait.
Sure. Yeah, just this is a really interesting topic because I think it's easy to not really examine the motivation behind generosity completely. And when I say completely, just as you described, there may be a mutual benefit. And I look at things sometimes from it's hard to avoid a bias as to the benefits, because I want to say that a lot of times the generosity that I'm aware of on my part, there is a reciprocal benefit for me. And I'm not sure that that's bad sometimes. It has to be examined. That's pretty much the comment that I wanted to make. I often find that my time and my attention are even more beneficial sometimes in an experience. Today, I was actually late getting home because a former neighbor had shared with me the passing of her father, and she wanted to let me know how, you know, bring me up to speed on, she lives not far, she moved pretty close by, and I pass by the house when I'm biking around, and I thought it was very, I was happy that she shared it with me, and I wanted to give her as much of my presence and my concern, which was genuine. In the back of my mind, I was thinking, I'm going to miss some of the meditation. And as it was, I felt that it was important and beneficial in a way also for me to be able to be present for her. And I've experienced that in conversations with strangers too. I had one earlier today, and I had one yesterday, because I find that a lot of times people are distressed. I encounter them everywhere, and what I get from them is they need someone to hear them. I don't know if that's the case, and it's always been the case, but it seems almost more so today in this time. And maybe it's because of my having, let's just say, being mature. I don't want to take up a lot of time, but I hope I'm explaining it in a way that makes sense. But I think people are really, in many cases, suffering so much. We've had a lot of things going on in our society that have created a lot of dukkha. And I'm speaking specifically of things that have happened in the past 5 years that have disrupted so much of our lives. And especially young people who've gone through what I never went through in terms of lockdowns and pandemic and this and that, in their development, their developmental years. So I think
what I'm you're saying, there's an intersection between generosity and compassion in that regard?
I think so. I think it is both. And my ability, it makes me feel warm and good when I can do that, because if I'm with somebody, they'll let me know. And even if it's over the phone, I had somebody call me, and she happens to be a new student at FSU, at Florida State. And we had an interesting interaction. And she seemed to be getting a lot of benefit from my reflection, because she's at the very beginning of, she just is beginning her college years. And I could be her granny, you know, easily, or even older, you know. And life's experience, and Peter, I mean, you certainly, and all of the people who are in Sangha have a path and an experience that they're sharing, that you have. I mean, there are people who are members of the Sangha who have skills and so much to share, and I think that in and of itself is generous to be able to do that.
Yeah, it's important to be willing to be generous, and there's an association regarding generosity and patience, being willing to provide a compassionate presence when someone is trying to work through whatever their challenges are. But I want to make sure we have time for Andy, Sharon.
That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you, Ali. It was very enlightening. Enjoyed. Anyway, yeah, I mean, talk about generosity, you know, giving and receiving. I just had the opportunity, the pleasure of spending the weekend with my grandkids, and talk about, you know, getting something from giving. It's like, it ended up being really kind of a drag at the end of it, because I had to miss flights and stuff coming home. But I was sitting in the airport and, you know, waiting for a plane that, you know, and then getting bumped and stuff, and just thinking, just so what? You know, this was just a really wonderful experience. And, you know, I don't get to see him that often. And in fact, I'm going to be going away out of the country for a year. So this is the last time for a while. But it was just little eyes, just so grateful for little things. I mean, things that I took for granted that I was doing just because you would do them. And I didn't go there for that reason, but that's what I came back with. And it's, you know, not just in this situation, but in many situations in life, if I allow myself, it can be that way. You know, and I do remember one time where someone wanted to give me something, and I'm like, no, I don't need it. That's cool. But they actually said to me, you know, you're taking away my opportunity to give you something. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay. And so thank you for this topic tonight.
Thank you, Andy. That is really a testament of what often is the outcome of these acts of generosity. I think George.
Yeah, I'm a guest, new guest here. I'm a friend of Ali's, and I'm glad to be here and hear all the things that you guys are sharing, and Ali, your talk. I don't know, I'll just move to sort of in this question of the dynamic between giving and receiving. I was just sort of, this image came to mind, or first sort of thinking about how I think the place from which you give and the place to which you then receive are really the same sort of source, in that like it's sort of like a lovingness or a loving kindness. So in kind of this image came to mind of like being at this well where, you know, when you're giving to someone, you're dipping your bucket into this well, and sort of like the sort of beautiful waters are of this well are sort of like dripping onto your hands as you're handing over this bucket, and you're reabsorbing this like beautiful lovingness almost back through your skin. You know what I mean? You're feeling the goodness of that sharing of giving. It's like, and so what Andy was saying of like, it's giving back to you in the moments that you're giving, because you're kind of like this loving kindness is spilling out onto you in the same moment that you're handing out your bucket. But then the same thing when someone hands you a bucket of giving, you know, and you're bringing it back to your well. And this kind of maybe pulls into like what someone in the ins and Will was saying, you know, of like being burnt out. It's like, well, we have to love ourselves with a certain loving kindness to receive what other people are giving us, a certain permeability. The well has to be open, and like to bring the bucket back to fill back up your well, from which you will then draw upon to give out again. So I don't know, I think there's a very synergistic sort of filling and taking out and filling between the giving and the receiving.
I'd
It's a
like to
very
hear a story about the complications regarding what the last few comments have been focused on. This is a story that Ram Dass tells. He wrote a book about kindness and service. But basically, you know, they eradicated some kind of world disease systematically around the world, and the last area where it was found was in a village, a remote village in India. And these people, I think they were probably Jain, which is Jain, very spiritual discipline as old as Buddhism, that really focuses on harmlessness. And so these people wanted to protect this disease. They didn't want to harm the disease because it's part of the natural order. So the folks who came in to give them the inoculations, they had a ritual battle. One of the people who was the invading team, so to speak, with the vaccine, fought with the leader of the village. And I don't know how violent the fight was, but it was meant to represent that conflict. And there was this fight, and eventually the village leader succumbed and was vaccinated. And after that, everyone else in the village lined up to be vaccinated. And then they took a little bit of the food, all the food they have left in this poor village, and shared it with a team of people that came to inoculate them. So that's a really interesting intersection between compassion and generosity and fear and fearlessness. But it's sort of like a symbolic gesture that illustrates this whole issue about generosity and compassion and attachment to view. So I remembered that as y'all were talking. I think it's a really wonderful story.
Yeah, I feel like that wrapped up just so many of the concepts just in one story. So thank you for sharing that. I mean, we're out of time anyway, so.
Yes, we are. Thank you very much for your presentation, Allie. I really appreciate it. And next week, I'm going to talk about my insights regarding neuroplasticity as being a way to understand sunyata, which is translated as emptiness or voidness. It's our custom at the end of our meetings for us to sit together momentarily. Let's do that. Thank you for your practice. Wish you well. Hope we're all reasonably safe and happy until the next time we have a chance to chat.